Okay, I want to welcome you for coming tonight to the history of Orthodox Judaism in Los Angeles. I want to thank Rabbi Muskin and Young Israel Century City for hosting the first two parts. I know the poster gets confusing, but I wanted to purposely keep it moving around to different locations because different histories of LA are going to be included. I started this just as a small series on the other side of town, and it really, I was uncovering things I never thought I'd uncover. UCLA opened up archives. Really, people came forward with some amazing stuff. And what I found was we really have a remarkable history out here in Los Angeles. And the shame is that most of us don't even realize it. We all see ourselves as part of a distinct and disparate, you know, communities that just happen to meet up for a program here or there. But that's about it. And that couldn't be further from the truth. I want to start from I saw an article recently about a beautiful article about the end of ghost chasing in Los Angeles. How Los Angeles, you know, had a little cult movement that was flourishing in the 50s, 60s, and 70s of people who loved haunted houses, ghost chasing, searching in old homes for ghosts. And it's a dying breed, Nelly. One of the last ghost chasers is out of business in LA. And the article, beautifully written, he says that Los Angeles has always had a need for new dreamers. Los Angeles has always had a need for new dreamers. And if you take that concept, you're going to see that that animates the entire history of Los Angeles, the fact that this city became a place that always had a need for new dreamers. The thesis for tonight's first part is that Los Angeles, from the very beginning, became a community that collected the rabbi, the businessman, the merchant, and they worked and built together hand in hand. That would become a trademark of Los Angeles up until this day. What I mean is that Los Angeles is built by the relationship between, not just some rabbi came and built all LA. It didn't work like that. You have that in some cities in America. A certain individual came out and built the city. In LA, it was a collaboration of multiple people, leaders, wealthy individuals, rabbis, different lay leaders, different people coming together at the right place and time to develop each of these little communities. It didn't start the same as most communities do, where there's an influx suddenly from a certain community and the Jewish community moves from here and shifts to there. No, LA starts as individuals. And that's going to define Los Angeles Jewry, I believe, even to this day. Pockets of individuals coming together to create something meaningful and making a difference. In the book California, which is written by Kevin Starr, arguably the biggest authority on the history of California, he says the following. It was all happening so quickly. Not for California would there be, nor would there ever be, as it turned out, a deliberate process of development. California would rather develop impetuously through booms of people and abrupt releases of energy. This 14-part series is going to focus on these abrupt releases of energy that take place over the course of history or modern history as our series starts technically in 1840, as we start from 1840. What happens is in the mid-1860s is the building of the Transcontinental Railroad through this merger of epic private and public financing and construction. Californians play a huge role in its development. The 1850s, you have the rapid expansion of railroad service throughout the United States as a whole. So people are going to gradually start making their way out here to this empty place called California. Los Angeles County, and let's not focus just on California, Los Angeles County specifically has a strong viticulture, which is taking care of grapevines, very strong, together with fruit and vegetable production. That already is going to give it an extra push in the pre-1900s. The gold rush gives it an extra push for California to grow and to develop. And gives a strong second wind with another cattle industry as well, which creates what was called the cattle boom at the beginning of the 1800s, as thousands of cattle are driven west and driven north, down from South America. The first settlers that come to live in the land is known as City of Angels, were farmers of mixed blood. they established a basic tolerance for all people. You understand? Because since LA becomes this collection of random individuals just coming either to thrive in the cattle business or grapevines or fruits or produce or whatever else, the railroad work, whatever you came to California for, and specifically Los Angeles, it was a big mishmash. And what that meant was you by nature were going to be ethnically more tolerant of other people. That would benefit the early Jews that came here and other immigrants that came to California. So what then brought the Jews to California, to Los Angeles? What tempts them to confront the hardships of a journey from Europe and the East Coast and try their luck in this very lawless town? So we have to look at what this town looked like as the Jews first begin to arrive in 1850. Imagine a small frontier town where the only street is Main Street. It has occasional rough, dusty paths that lead somewhere to a couple of tents and crudely made hovels of commerce. Graded streets and sidewalks were practically unknown at that time. There was a lack of civilization, a lack of genteel behavior. Relatively few women were seen out in the streets, and most people rode on horseback to get from point A to point B over the muddy streets. The center of LA, the main part of it was a place called, and excuse my language this evening, was a place called Nigger Alley. It was a home to a place that housed a murder a day. 1871, 18 Chinese people were killed on that very street or that very area of LA. Los Angeles was such a mess, so lawless going in the 1850s, that the Pueblo Indians themselves, who knew how to pick a good fight, called Los Angeles Helltown. So now picture us Nebuch Jews picking a city where to go, and for some odd reason, a bunch of Jews pick Helltown. Pick Los Angeles to move to. Into this Helltown enter the first 8 Jews, all of them bachelors. The 1850 census of Los Angeles records the first 8 Jews in the city. Here they are. Jacob Frankfurt, Stephen Bernstein, no, I'm kidding, Morris Michaels, Arnold Jacoby, Augustin Wasserman, Felix Pachman, Philip Sichel, Joseph Plummer, and Morris Goodman. They were basically a combination from Germany and Poland. Who's Morris Goodman? Morris Goodman is elected to Los Angeles' first city council in 1850. I'll put it in the way that William Cramer, probably one of the greatest historians of Jews on the West Coast, says. Jews have wandered the earth for some 4,000 years. This constant search for a promised land is both literal and figurative. And it was the promise of a good life that brought the early pioneers to Los Angeles. But why Los Angeles? There were other cultivated cities. Number one, and this was a trend throughout history for Sephardim. The Sephardic people often tended to migrate towards coastal cities. They were better for business and trade. Find the harbor, park your spot there, and you'll have yourself a good business. So some people chose Los Angeles because of its proximity towards the West Coast, towards the Pacific Ocean, towards uncharted waters, which could open up a whole new trade and industry. Number two, a new city that's just beginning to develop with all these additions, like I told you, cattle and fruits and everything, created tremendous opportunity. And number three, these were young men. They were hungry to prove themselves. They were hungry to explore and to experiment. And they simply came to try out their abilities in a new world. Jews felt immediately when they hit the ground in achrayus, irresponsibility, to get involved in politics. And because of their talents and their skills, Jews were welcomed right away. One of the first leaders of the Jewish community, one of the first names you need to know, was Joseph Newmark. He brought with him a Chinese servant who we now know was paid $100 per month. Who, by the way, his servant is believed to be the first Chinese person in Los Angeles. They would be an important group because they would go on to build many of the intricate railroad systems that would feed into Los Angeles. Joseph Newmark is sort of the acting rabbi in Los Angeles. He doesn't have smicha. Probably all of us in the room could wipe the floor with the amount of Torah knowledge he had. But it was the best LA could do at the time. And he had leadership qualities. He establishes a small community. And then in 1862, he brings in Los Angeles' first rabbi. If we're ever on the game show and they ask you, who's Los Angeles' first rabbi? Here we go. Rabbi Avram Edelman. Rabbi Abraham Edelman is the first rabbi of Los Angeles. Together with Joseph Newmark, who was acting as rabbi till he was able to bring in Edelman, who came over from a stopover in San Francisco, they established the congregation B'nai B'rith. Anybody know what Congregation B'nai B'rith is going to become later on? Wilshire Boulevard Temple. So the first shul in Los Angeles is Congregation B'nai B'rith. It's later going to become Wilshire Boulevard Temple. Newmark, now that he's no longer the acting rabbi, so to speak, he starts the Hebrew Benevolent Society, which is going to put together the first burial plots for Jews. You know where it is? You can still see the plaque to this day. It's in the smack in the middle of Chavez Ravine, smack in the middle of Dodger Stadium. Right there was the first area of the Hebrew Benevolent Society. The plaque is nearby. You could see it. That's where he planted, where Jews, when they would begin to die, that's where they can go right there. He knew already, he had Nevuah already, that's going to be hallowed ground in that area in Chavez Ravine. So that's the area he picked. Three Sephardic Jews play. So we have our Macher, that's Joseph Newmark. Right? We have our politician, Morris Goodman, and we have our rabbi, Rabbi Avram Edelman. Now, where are the Sephardim? Sephardim play a big role as well in the early settling of Los Angeles. Three Sephardic Jews in particular. Two of them are brothers, Samuel and Joseph Labat. They happen to be, this is their stat, they are the first native-born American Jews in Los Angeles. You understand? From every Jew in Los Angeles, they're not the first Los Angelino, not the first Jews to be born in L.A., but they're the first Jews to make it to L.A. who were born in America. They were born in New Orleans. Joseph and Samuel Labat, they make it over to Los Angeles. The most famous Sephardic Jew who would end up in Los Angeles right then was Salomon Nunez Carvajal. Salomon Nunez Carvajal is actually extremely famous, and you've probably seen some of his paintings. His photography, some of his early portraits. Who is he? An artist and a photographer. He traces his ancestry back to Spanish-Portuguese Jewry in London, 1700s. He knew Torah and Tehillim. They say he knew Torah and Tehillim by heart, completely and by heart. He was a great community organizer, and he would help Rabbi Edelman in really getting the shul fired up and moving. Why might we know his name, or why might we ought to know his name? So for the following reason. John C. Fremont. John C. Fremont was a famous American military officer, explorer, politician. He's the first candidate for the anti-slavery movement of the Republican Party to run for president. John C. Fremont. He's asked to leave the military because he has an anger management issue. When he thinks something needs to be done, he's not listening to anybody. But he's happier anyways, leaving the military and becoming an explorer. For his fifth and final expedition, he wants somebody who's going to capture all the majestic moments. He asks the Jewish Sephardic artist, Salomon Nunez Carvajal, to come along with him on his fifth expedition and paint and take pictures of anything you see, because I want this amazing marvel to be remembered. And his portraits and his pictures have been collected in books, and they're in museums throughout the country. Salomon Carvajal, very important figure, capturing early Americana, early American history, and also one of the first Jews, one of the first Sephardic Jews in Los Angeles. A couple of important bachelors continue. Why do I keep saying bachelors? You know why? Because the shidduch pool out in Los Angeles, it's tough to schlep the family out to Los Angeles, right? You got the wife and you got kids and you got everything. How are you bringing them? Tell them, let's go. We got a great opportunity in LA. There's nothing there. How are you going to get a Jewish family to move to where there's nothing there? So that's why a lot of the people who came were curious people, who had adventurous spirits, who had nothing, so to speak, that they needed to concern or worry themselves about besides just surviving. An important bachelor shows up. His last name is Hellman. The Hellman family is a very important family. They are going to become the money, not for the Jewish community, the money in Los Angeles altogether. They literally will bring banking into Los Angeles. Wells Fargo ultimately thrives and succeeds because of the Hellman family. So let's keep that name Hellman in our minds. We're going to come back to it. Joseph Newmark, remember our first macher, an acting rabbi. He marries Rosa Levy. She becomes the chief fundraiser for Loyola University. I'm telling you that because that shows you how involved Jews were right away in civic life. They didn't sit off to the corner, remove themselves, and just do what they needed to do. Right away from the very beginning, Jews felt a responsibility to build Los Angeles, get on those boards, make a difference, and start building the city from the ground up. And therefore, what that means is when you talk about the founding of the Los Angeles Jewish community, what you're really saying is you're talking about the founding of the Los Angeles community. Not just the founding of Los Angeles Jewish community. The founding of the Los Angeles Jewish community ultimately is partially responsible for building Los Angeles as a whole. And that should be a matter of great pride that I think most Jews in LA don't even realize how instrumental we were in the building of Los Angeles. Let's talk about the first shul. Now, I know this is called the history of Orthodox Judaism in Los Angeles. And I chose that specifically because there is a lot documented on Reform and Conservative in LA. You go also, there's a whole segment, in Hollywood history in Los Angeles. There's an extra emphasis, even on the books. If you were to research the books that are out there, they sort of ignore the Orthodox history in Los Angeles. And it's a shame that it's ignored, as you'll see as our history course goes along. But at the beginning, everybody's Orthodox. What I mean by that is there are no denominations here at the beginning. These are just a bunch of Jews struggling to survive. So while the shul I'm about to describe looks like something that is extremely Reform, it wasn't Reform in ideology. You understand this? These were Jews who were just trying to get together as Jews. That's an Orthodox, that's a conservative concept. In a no man's land, in the middle of chaos, to be able to band together as a group and pray to one God, to Hashem, say Shema Yisrael, that is where religion starts in LA for the Jewish people. So we have this shul, Congregation B'nai B'rith, which is later going to become Wilshire Temple. They begin working on a building as they see one by one, people are starting to trickle in. The building goes up sometime during early July or August 1873. The building is complete. The newspaper at the time, the Los Angeles Express, says as follows. The dedication of the Hebrew synagogue on 4th Street will be a ceremony of great interest. The ceremonies will commence this evening at 5 o'clock under the auspices of Rabbi Edelman and the members of the B'nai B'rith Society. This is a tiny congregation, 40 families, but they are of bold heart. So 40 Jews, 40 families get together and build a synagogue. This was news in Los Angeles. This was news in Los Angeles. The article lists who was the president then. Who was the president? Vice president was Joseph Newmark, right? The founding acting rabbi. The president is I.W. Hellman. I told you, he's going to become the major money in Los Angeles, the father of banking in LA. The article says they open with a song by the choir. The song is in Hebrew, "How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob." What song is that? Matovo Alecha Yaakov, recited in Hebrew. The first three verses of Genesis in Hebrew and in English. This is the wild, wild west. This is Helltown. These are people killing each other, one people dead a day. And in the middle of mamish betoch hachoshech, mamish in the middle of darkness, a bunch of Jews who are business-minded, civic-minded, stop and get together. They could have left everything behind. They were in a world that was without their religion. They could have left it behind. The trappings of religion is that it gives us social connection. They could have found more social connection, perhaps without their Judaism. The sustenance of the programming that we have and the kosher restaurants. They didn't need any of that. So why did they all come together? But they wanted to find meaning even while they were out there exploring in Los Angeles. The day after, you think the Los Angeles Star was done talking about Jews? No, the next day they ran a cover story. The dedication of the Hebrew synagogue took place yesterday afternoon. It was one of the grandest spectacles ever witnessed in Southern California. The congregation B'nai B'rith may well feel proud of their house of worship. Listen to this line here. And again, you have to understand, they can only write this because LA is a hodgepodge. It's a mix of cultures and people. It is the most superior church edifice in Southern California. And it is a standing credit to those who liberally provided for its erection, for its arising and its standing as the first synagogue in Los Angeles. It's going to stay there from 1873 to 1896 until they're ready for a larger building and a move. Let's talk about our first rabbi, Rabbi Avram Wolf Edelman, the first rabbi of Los Angeles. He's going to serve as rabbi from 1862 to 1885. Now, here is a bit of a fight as to what exactly happened, a bit of a disagreement among historians as to what happened to Rabbi Edelman. He was born in Poland in 1832. He comes to the United States with his wife, Chana Pesha Cohen, in 1851. 8 years later, he moves to San Francisco, where he studies Hebraic studies, teaching Hebrew. He's trained to become a rabbi and a chazan. There is somewhat of a constituency in San Francisco, but it's not for our class. Joseph Newmark meets Rabbi Edelman on a visit to San Francisco, and he knows that Rabbi Edelman would be perfect for the just developing Los Angeles community. Why was Rabbi Edelman perfect? Rabbi Edelman was a perfect spokesman for the Los Angeles community because he spoke Spanish, which made him also appreciated and respected by the natives, so to speak, by many of the people who were not even Jewish in the area, so much so that he got the nickname soon in. He was called Padre. They called him Padre, Rabbi Padre Edelman. He was an ambassador, a spokesman for Judaism in America, until finally he is asked in 1885, the family, the Newmark family, Joseph's son, Harris, who is now running the shul, Harris Newmark gets up and says, Rabbi Edelman will step down. Now, why does he say Rabbi Edelman will step down? This is what he says. Now, what's difficult with history is you have to distinguish between what's said and what really occurred. And sometimes people say things for political reasons. What he said was that Rabbi Edelman is not adapting well to our new religious version of life. Our reforming congregation needs a reforming rabbi. And Rabbi Edelman's bends and leanings towards orthodoxy make it untenable for him to stay in the B'nai B'rith congregation. So what it seems like, at face value, is you have a farfrumtana rabbi. He's too frum for the people. The people want to enjoy. They want to sit together, mix seating. They want to bring in instruments. They want to make it a whole show. And the rabbi is from the old school. He's from the shtiebel life, and so on and so forth. Now here's the problem. We have plenty of writings from Rabbi Edelman. Rabbi Edelman writes, with joy. I remember the joy when we brought in the organist for the first time into our house of worship. What beautiful sounding music it was to all those who are present, as we sit together with our families, listening to the chanting choirs. A later letter, Rabbi Edelman writes, how I think I'm going to move many of the prayers to English so that the people understand what they are saying. And by the way, his sermons were in English. If he was anti-reform, what else did you want him to do? He was excited about the instrument. He loves the choir and had no problems moving the congregation to English prayer service. By the way, can a congregation go to English? So there's a great tshuva, a great responsa from Rabbi Jung, who was the great rabbi in Manhattan at the Jewish Center. Rabbi Jung spoke. He sent a letter to, he was in Switzerland at the time, the Sri Dei Esh. Sent the letter to the Sri Dei Esh asking him what he thought. Sri Dei Esh said, technically, totally fine. but I prohibit it. Why? Because you're making a statement that you're no longer an Orthodox congregation. It's fine to daven in English, but the statement is worse. Rabbi Edelman had no problems. His diary says it. He had no issue with it. So what in the world is Newmark talking about? What is he talking about? We'll never know for sure. But mestama, it means they wanted somebody young and hip. And the nicest way to say that is just to say that he's too pious for us. You're overqualified for the job. You understand? What way are they going to move someone who's already been here for 20 years and they want some new young blood in the congregation? The only way you're going to do that in a way that allows him to save face is tell him how pious and how religious and how observant he is, and we're just not there yet. That's the number one theory on the ground. To say he was anti-reform, we have no evidence of any document, any diary entry of his, that he was against any innovation whatsoever in that community. Well, bumping Rabbi Edelman out of the shul meant something very interesting, because as we'll see next week, he was going to assist in the first Orthodox congregation in LA. He was going to become the Malamed in that first Orthodox synagogue, teaching Hebrew classes in the afternoon. See, kicking him out of their movement of whatever it meant automatically then relegated him to a more Orthodox circle by pushing him in that direction. He has 6 children, 2 girls, along with his wife, 2 girls, and 4 boys. By the way,
how old was he?
I don't remember. I don't remember how old, but he was definitely old. You look at the pictures of his last few years, and we have pictures of him in his last few years at B'nai B'rith, and you see a totally white beard at that point. Something of interesting to note is you have to understand, much of the congregation were Western European Jews. He was from Poland. So already there, while he may have had no problem with the rituals adapting to reform or new rituals, he might still have been from an old school as far as his mindset, and that could be a major difference as well. The money behind building B'nai B'rith, the next B'nai B'rith, is this Hellman family. Now, I want to read to you one of the opening remarks from the president at the opening days of this synagogue. We are assembled here today to lay the cornerstone of this, our future synagogue. It's a happy moment for all of us Hebrews to be present and assist on this holy occasion. You, Mr. Edelman, meaning Rabbi Edelman, they called him Mr., who has for the last 10 years so ably performed all your duties as teacher to our children, chazen, shochet, spiritual advisor to our society. You, always the first at any sickbed, or giving consolation to the afflicted. To you, we can say, well done, faithful servant of God. May the all-powerful compensate you. May all your days be days of joy. He keep you and yours well for many years. So it started exciting and with love, but the relationship would ultimately fray, and they would send Rabbi Edelman out, replace him with somebody younger in the congregation. One person who was there, we have a congregant who was there, who wrote down notes from their observations of being in the synagogue. Look what this individual wrote. If the piety of the members did not extend to eating only kosher food, or suspending businesses on the Sabbath, on the Jewish New Year, on Day of Atonement, they were impeccable. They all closed their places of business, and some merchants from outlying areas moved into Los Angeles for the days. When the high holidays came around, religion in Los Angeles began to take hold, began to strengthen, began to invigorate itself. High holidays in Los Angeles was respected and was revered. Now, let's move to the 1880s. The 1880s are marked by oranges and a railroad boom. 80% of the Jews at the time are white-collar professions. That leads to a huge increase in the population. This was a golden age for Jews in Los Angeles. Now, the non-Jews, many of them, or if not most of them, could not read. And they were not educated. So you know what that means? It meant that if you had all this gold, where did you put it? You know where you put this gold if you were not Jewish? You trusted only one group of people with your money. And that was, you left it with the Jews. That's how the Jews started banking in Los Angeles. They were educated, they were responsible, people trusted them, and they gave them their money to hold on to. And they became some of the wealthiest people in the country. Herman Hellman, I told you about the Hellman family. Listen to this. In 1883, was paying $89,000 in property tax. That is the highest by any individual in the entire country. In the entire country, it's a Jew whose father is a president of the only synagogue in Los Angeles. The Hellmans are going to go on to build USC, and Hellman, as I said, would become the president of Wells Fargo. With this established Los Angeles, they're the bankers, they're the professionals, they're the ones who are educated and teach each other, and people trust them. That leads to an infusion of Eastern European Jews in the 1880s. Polish, Prussian Jews had a very difficult time acclimating. Western European Jews, German Jews, enlightened Jews, they mixed in so well in Los Angeles. And that's why the historians leave behind the Eastern European Jews in LA. They really forget about them. Pick any book you want off the shelf about Los Angeles Jewry. The Eastern European Jews were considered like peasants. They ignored them. And therefore, it's going to be our job to uncover that history and peel through the piles and the layers of Eastern European Jewry. Now, when does anti-Semitism come to Los Angeles? It started as a melting pot. If you're a melting pot, you accept everyone. Anti-Semitism comes to Los Angeles in the 1890s. Why? Because a nationwide depression takes hold in 1893. What does that mean? It's going to bring struggling pioneers heading west, coming from Iowa, Kansas, Missouri. These people are by and large low class, of poor temperament, and have spent very little time with people other than themselves. And they will bring intolerance to Los Angeles, which will then weave itself a little bit into the fabric of LA for the next 40, 45 years. It'll linger in Los Angeles. Now, something amazing turned up. I found a poster when I was looking through the archives at UCLA. Let's take a step back. The founder of the Chabad movement is Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya had a grandson whose name was Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson. Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson is born in 1833 in Russia. He arrives in New York for the first time in 1869. Why? He's a fundraiser for the Zionist movement in Palestine, later to be Israel. He's a religious Zionist leader, a one-man fundraising machine, going from city to city to city. His goal is to improve relations between U.S. and Palestine, raise money for Israel. He gives a world-famous lecture on February 17, 1869, at the New York Historical Society, after which he goes to Washington, and as best we know, he is the first rabbi to meet a standing U.S. president. He meets with President Grant. We have some basic minutes from that meeting. Now, here is what, documented by a secretary, here is what the rabbi said in his meeting with President Ulysses S. Grant. "My president, permit me to give my thanks to the Almighty, whose mercy brought me here to behold the face of the chosen by the millions of this great nation." He's speaking to him as though he's standing in front of the Tsar of Russia. "I come to your excellency from the east." We don't speak like that to presidents, even at that point in American history. "To entreat you in the name of God who created all men equal, to listen to the prayer of your humble servant standing before you, to advocate the cause of his oppressed brethren in the Holy Land." He begins to make the case that AIPAC tries to make. The case that a strong Palestine is a strong United States and a strong Palestine are when they are close toward each other. And that's the case he makes before the president. The secretary writes that the president was moved by the rabbi's sincere and feeling words. He continued to ask to the circumstances affecting the Jews, specifically in the holy city of Jerusalem. He started asking about what's happening now in Jerusalem. And he said, our people don't get any protection. The Christian community has protection. The Jews have no protection. So he met President Grant. Why do I tell you this? 1871, he makes it to California and then to Los Angeles. So on our game show, when somebody asks you, the first Hasidic Rebbe, he's got the whole garb. We have a drawing. We have one drawing of him. He has Hasidic garb. He walks with a gartel. He looks like what we imagine a Hasidic Rebbe would have looked in the 1800s. The first Hasidic rabbi to step foot in Los Angeles is going to be Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson. He comes to Los Angeles. The Newmark family hears that the great Rabbi Chaim, the venerable Rabbi Chaim Tzvi Schneerson is here. They ask him to speak, and I have the poster, copy of it. Lectures by Rabbi Schneerson. The public are respectfully informed that the celebrated traveler, the Maggid, Rabbi Schneerson, will deliver two lectures in this city at Wilson's Hall on the evening of Thursday the 11th at Tuesday the 16th, August at 8 o'clock p.m. Subjects, the past and present condition of Palestine, and Hebron, Cave of Machpelah, and the general customs of the Jews, Turks, and Arabs. Admission to both lectures, $1.50. $1.50 for the admission, you get a twofer, you get both lectures for the price of one. So the first Hasidic Rebbe, imagine this LA community, so detached from anything that's Jewish outside of what they've created for their Judaism in Los Angeles, hungry for something, finally getting a taste of the world that they were once a part of, or once had heard of, as Rav Schneerson comes to Los Angeles. The amazing thing about his visit is he stays at a hotel, which is downtown. He stays at a hotel, and because he's there for several weeks, he happens to be there while the government sends a census of California to go around and take a listing of who's there. If you are to look at citizens of America in 1871, because he was in town, he makes the cut as a citizen of Los Angeles and a citizen of United States. You just have to be alive and in America at that time. Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson then becomes the first Hasidic rabbi to become a citizen, as best we know, of the United States and certainly of Los Angeles, because he happened to be here as the census was going on. It's amazing. If you were to go through a census at that time, you would not see a lot of Jewish names, but you would see Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson, his name there in the census, which is an amazing thing. He goes back to Tveria, where he's put in Cherem. Why was he put in Cherem and banished from his own hometown? Could be because of his secular Zionist friends, his Chevra, or some say it's because he was fundraising in churches. Two separate strands among historians as to why he was banished from Tveria. Nebuch, he died alone in South Africa while on a fundraising trip, raising money for Israel. And really, for that schus alone to mention his name tonight, a hero of the Jewish people, a hero for the future state of Israel, someone who just gave his whole life, gave everything on behalf of the Jewish people. And to know that that played an interesting little twist in the history of Los Angeles, I personally find fascinating. And it's going to be animated by many of these little side stories of where LA will play home to. The shul takes a little turn. The economy begins to dip in the late 1880s. We said you have the economy dropping in 1893. 1890s, the economy down. Spiritual depth is at an all-time low in Los Angeles, Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson's visit notwithstanding. No other Jewish leader would arrive in Los Angeles till someone by the name of Rabbi Moses Solomon comes in 1896. It's around there you're going to meet Los Angeles' first gadol. First Gon, I should say. someone with encyclopedic knowledge of not just the Bible and Tehillim, but also of the Talmud as well. We're going to meet some of those figures. But there's a book by Harris Newmark, right? Joseph Newmark, our first Macher. His son Harris Newmark led the community for 60 years. And he wrote a book. It's a very fascinating book. It's called 60 Years in Southern California, 1853 to 1915. All I need are the last few words of his book and tells you everything about what's happening with this community. The last words of his book are, "I am a citizen of Los Angeles." I am a citizen of Los Angeles. Jews in LA, unlike Jews initially in New York, Jews initially in Milwaukee, Jews initially and never in Kansas, Jews for the first time, after they come to Los Angeles, say, "I am a citizen of Los Angeles." There is a tremendous pride for the Jews here in the Los Angeles community, a huge pride, and that pride is felt by the people among them. What I want to continue, God willing, next Monday night, 8:30. We're going to continue part two. I want to talk about the pride of the Jews of LA as we go to the beginning of the 1900s. Talk about Orthodoxy's influence in Hollywood, Orthodoxy's influence in the original Talmidei Chachamim who would show up in LA and start to uncover some of the best kept secrets in the history of Frum LA going back to the beginning of the 1900s. I thank you for coming out tonight.